session number 11530, rule 4.
Going on a bit, aren't we? Dr. Roy Tildesley, rule 4, if you would bear with me a little longer. Yes. We're talking about the FAU members and the sort of ethos in the unit. In a situation like this, you know, relief, an extreme situation in a way, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, there would be usually a consensus of agreeing what the leader suggested. It was a leader who would suggest the line we would take about certain things, but it was entirely a matter of consensus management. I remember one time we got into the front line, a bit too near the front line, and we were being shot at by shells or something. And one of our group, I forget his name now, was an older man, actually. He was probably the oldest of the group, probably about 30, so quite old. And he said, "You're a bloody fool, you know, you want to come out of here. There's no need to be running a first aid dressing station up here. There's plenty of places back there we can go and get the casualties without going up there." But Graham had decided that we ought to bed down in this farmhouse for the night, and we stuck a Red Cross on the top and stayed there. But it was, looking back, it was a bit risky and probably unnecessarily risky. But it was... So there were differences of views about what we should do sometimes, but by and large, most of us are young and accepted what the leader told us. We hadn't a great deal of vast experience. Nobody had of situations like that. Yes, as regards the more worldly side of things, I think I learnt to smoke in the FAU because the rations came up free in those days. I thought it was very, very grown-up to smoke, and even drinking, which my father would turn in his grave, he knew I'd touched alcohol. I'd experimented with, as it were, because, again, the rations, you get it more cheaply, is one of the things. Remember, there's no television or wireless, so all amusement had to be within the group, either amusing each other or playing a piano or something, if you find one, or talking, or just reading. So there's more time for these things. I think one of the members invited a girlfriend, which is rather difficult because in a group of 12 people in a small house, one had to wonder where it would stop if you started fraternising to that degree, if you did this. Not that we banned having friendships, but that sort of situation you get in those days. Remember that students of universities they were locked up at 10:30 or what it was. So this is sort of situation you had to face. And again, one had to think about the image it would create if we were seen as a helping organisation in the Ruhr to be having lots of women in all every night. It would look not quite the sort of image we were trying to get across to the Germans, as being impartial social workers, as it were.
How about the FAU women? You know, were you finding there were any about on the ground in Germany?
I think there are a few. I didn't come in our section. There are very few. I think there were one or two in others, I'm not sure. But they came in much later when I left in about 46. They were coming in when, in fact, the FRS had a lot more women in. In fact, our section was asked, did we want women in or not? That was about 1946. And I think the consensus in our section was no. But again, that was taken the wrong way, as either we're gay or we're queer or something. But it was pure convenience. I thought, you know, I think the majority thought it was convenient with all the primitive conditions you get at times, sanitation and so on. At that time, it wasn't too bad, but you can never tell in a situation what you're going to get, there's enough intrigue amongst men, but a mixture of men and women, sometimes young people, leads to more trouble sometimes. As a unit, one's seen this, so you think, well, so I think we voted against it. Not that it stopped us having women in the end, but we were asked about it, so that's where it was run. It wasn't run exactly as it was wished on us within the women came along later on.
How about your relations with the army? You know, because obviously you were having more to do with soldiers.
Yes, I think they were very good on the whole. I mean, we didn't have an awful lot to do with them, but certainly at Oldenburg we had quite a lot to do with them there, and we got on very well with them.
Did they understand your situation? They knew you were pacifist relief workers.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, usually there's a... I think the medicine is an angle, you see. I think one forgets how Order of St John and things like that have through the ages kept this humanitarian touch throughout. And the military government usually had a medical officer on his staff. Or the chap in charge of us had a medical officer on the staff. So there's always a sane person you could appeal to, or... And I always felt that. I don't think they had to, but I mean, you can't get two or three officers. The major, probably a pucker military man, but he'd probably been not demoted, but at least out of the front line, because he wasn't that keen on the front line, I guess. He'd probably opted to do this rather than. So they weren't ogres at all, they were quite real people, very interesting people on the whole.
Were they interesting?
Yes, I find it interesting. Not having mixed with army people before. Some of the attitudes that they... It's a bravado, I think. It's a have-a-go-at-anything attitude, which... And a certain amount of intellectual reasoning, which is there, and they recognise limitations, but they would argue the case quite well, I thought. I don't mean necessarily about war and peace, but about practical issues.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel they... regarded and treated the German civilians? Did you form any opinion, you know, generally of the army, the British army?
Well, I really don't know. I mean, we only knowledge, really, of what went on at Oberhausen.
How was that?
I thought it was on the whole base reasonable. Again, I have no experience of it. I mean, the military government officer was down the corridor and he wasn't perfect. I'm sure no military government with that in that situation within 6 months of the end of the war would be lovey-dovey about it, but I think he was fair, I imagine. I don't recall any stories going around that he was a beast of Belsen or anything of that sort, which is, I think, says something for them. I think he was an ex-RAF chap, wasn't he, I think. Did David mention him? Or Inga? Because Inga worked for him, you see. I don't know whether she would know more about his goings on. Of course, her parents would be there. They would be able to report. But it's like anybody in charge. He's bound to make some mistakes and be misunderstood at times. And I'm sure would be imperfect, but I think he could have been a lot more vicious people around. It had been the other way around, I guess. The Germans are here.
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, because you were saying earlier on in the war that, you know, you felt no enmity to the Germans because you didn't know the full extent of... or to the Hitler regime, rather, because you didn't know the full extent of what happened. I imagine when you were in Europe, and Germany in particular, you were getting news of the death...
That's right, yes.
Yes, I wondered, you know, did that... what effect that had on your attitude towards... Germany, and I suppose really the Hitler regime. Did you sort of change your
stance
about the war?
No, it didn't really. No, I think the whole business about the Holocaust has got to be taken in context. The Jews, for all that they've suffered, they were a problem in the East. I understand. I'm quoting what, but they were a ruthless to a nationalist country. They're a ruthless lot, as you see now with them. As soon as they get difficult in Russia, they want to come out, and not only do they want to come out, but they want to go where they want to go, and the Russians are playing them up and saying, all right, you can go out, but you're Jews, you go back to Jerusalem, you see. And they don't like that. They want to go somewhere prosperous and want to go to America. And I think there's that about them, isn't there, which destabilised a lot of Eastern Europe. I'm only speaking, I know first-hand information, I'm just speaking of what I've read. And I think this is one of the problems that Hitler had, that there was a lot of intrigue aggravated by, if you like, the shiftlessness of the avaricious Jew. I have a great admiration for the Jews, don't get me wrong, but I'm talking about the situation I've been told or read about. And that one of Hitler's jobs was to, or at least any nation, was to get self-respect back and define a nation in some way. And I think that's what his method was, partly to go anti-Jewish. And added to which, of course, there was a very strong left-wing movement in Europe at that time, which was fanned by Russia, no doubt. And we all fell for it in a way, didn't we? All thought Russia was marvellous for a while, so I'm told. And I think that side of it, the Jews and the Russians were big, or at least the communism, were big destabilising influences in that area, which somehow had to be, I don't know, not cured, but faced anyway. I think that's all it is. Now, I don't approve what he did, but it's even being recognised now, isn't it? It doesn't go away. And I'm not defending Hitler at all for doing what he did in the slightest about the Jews, but some of it was aggravated by the war. The war gave him a marvellous chance. If there hadn't been a war, he wouldn't have got away with it. And the war, in a way, made everybody insensitive to everything. After all, we didn't think anything about bombing Germans, and nor did he think about bombing Jews. They were just a foreign nation as far as he's concerned. And I'm not defending it, but I'm just saying, morally, it's very similar, as I see it, to annihilating a township or whatever it is, to annihilating a lot of Jews in cold blood, admittedly, but then that's cold blood, whatever you do in war, isn't it? And I don't agree there's reasons for it at all. There are other ways of tackling, I'm sure. But this all came about, I'm sure, because, I'm not sure, but it's probably come about to some extent by the callousness engendered by war. It's almost a reason for not going to war, that you liberate these callous views of how to deal with situations. And much as I sympathise with the terrible tragedy, I think it's not a reason for saying everything must be fought out, because that's what you're doing. It brings out these worst base of things in people, which can only be fulfilled in secrecy in wartime. He wouldn't have got away with it in peacetime. In fact, to back this up, even Churchill, who had access to all the information in the world, was surprised at what went on. He reckoned he didn't know. So he reckoned with all the clever information that we're supposed to have had during the war, he didn't know that. That shows how clandestine this was, and I think a lot of Germans didn't know. They may have known there was suffering of some sort, but they had no idea what was really happening. That's my impression. I have no proof, but this is for what it's worth.
Yes, from what you've been, this is very interesting, what you've been telling me, and this implies to me that you ended the war with your pacifism intact.
Oh yes, more so than ever, probably.
More so?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Is that the, you know, seeing the effects of war, did it reinforce it?
Yes, I mean, it's blighted everyone's lives for the last 40 years, isn't it? I mean, we're still getting over it. Look at Russia and, you know, all this kerfuffle now. It's because Europe's put into a different shape by bullies on both sides, ignoring the reasonable claims of all the nations of Germany and Europe and everybody else, which have got to be met someday. You can't go on forever pretending the bullies can be there all the time. And we've had to put up with that nonsense for 40 years, plus all the economic ruin, plus all the deaths involved, and the chance for Hitler to do what he wanted to do with the Jews. I mean, you know, it depends how you do your accounting, isn't it?
Do you have any involvement with the peace movement today?
Not actively, no. I'm still a member of the Society of Friends. I'm a member of, what is it, a medical campaign against nuclear war. Passive member, do nothing from my subscription. No, I think it's a younger man's game. I mean, I've been to so many discussions about this sort of thing, and I really don't feel I have anything more to say apart from just personal stand, as it were.
This situation brewing up now in the Middle East, No, with this sort of there are various diplomatic moves, but a lot of military action now. You know, with the forces being sent. I wonder if you have, in the light of the lessons of World War II, how you react to it.
Oh. Well, ambivalent attitudes. First of all, I'm not. I think the issue is whether you believe in sanctions. Now, I used to believe in sanctions at one time. I thought that was jolly good. But again, as a schoolboy, I remember this chap, Empson, who was said he didn't believe in sanctions. It staggered me. Tell you, chap. And I've always had this ambivalence about sanctions. I'm never quite sure whether you should believe in them or not. It's a form of force, which ultimately, if your bluff is called, you've got to use military stuff. And that's what's happening now, isn't it? And your bluff is being called. And this may well trigger off another war. In theory, it sounds fine. I mean, economic sanctions sounds fine. And it may work. But it's a gamble. Ultimately, though, you've got to back it up with hardware, haven't you? Real hardware. And that's what America's doing. America knows this. The gamble is whether Hussein will test America's bluff as well.
But is there any alternative to sanctions, do you think, backed up by force?
I'm not sure about the Middle East. I'm not sure I know enough about it, but I suspect, as Ben said, that if it wasn't for oil, there'd be nobody there pretending to be all pie about integrity of frontiers and so on. I don't know enough history, but you probably know more than a lot more than I do about it, but I'm not sure who set up Kuwait, for example, who set up Emirate Republics. I don't know who set them up, who wrote the boundaries. I don't know. I'd like to know more about it before I pass any judgment about it. I suspect the remnants of a thing that suited us in the old days. Just a lot of Africa's like that. The boundaries suited us. And in terms of democracy and all that, there's no democracy in Saudi Arabia. Or, you know, all these sort of things are quietly forgotten at the moment, aren't they? I'm not sure we know enough about it, but we're presented, I think, at the moment by the media with a very limited picture of what the rights and wrongs of it are. I'm not defending Iraq at all. I think it's a real nasty bit of work, but he's talking like a revolutionary, isn't he? Drumming up the people's votes. But that's the way the Arabs think, apparently, isn't it?
The situation in Europe. Do you consider the how important do you think the FAU contribution to the relief service was in the areas that you experienced service? Did you get satisfaction with the work you were doing?
Oh yes, immense satisfaction. I did. Yes, immense satisfaction. I felt I was doing something worthwhile and constructive. I think it's minute, really. I don't think in world terms it's very important, and the levers of power can produce much more worldly goods from a military government than you can from the FAU, but within the context of what we're allowed to do, I think we did very well, and it's small perhaps compared with what some of the other relief agencies did before in World War I, like some of the Quaker relief and so on that went on. But then the world's a different place. There are no longer vast money bags to supply world relief, perhaps Oxfam or something like that, but Oxfam didn't exist then. And it would have probably been channeled through a different sort of group of people if it had been going then.
Do you think as pacifist you had something extra to offer that perhaps other groups hadn't?
I think so, yes. I think we're on the whole, probably an axe to grind. I think both sides realise that. I think any German or any Englishman thought of BS, perhaps, but, you know, decent, honest chaps. I think that would be, in a sort of shorthand way of putting it, it's a bit like Switzerland, isn't it? So you still need a Switzerland, don't you? In spite of all the European turmoil, every country needs its Switzerland. And I think that's perhaps something of the role we played. Or thought we were playing, I don't know where, but that's what we thought.
Did it have lasting effects on your life? Yes,
it was an education, really, to meet a lot of interesting people and travel. And education in politics and economics and everything. I mean, you can't avoid it in those situations. And of course, it made me decide to do medicine in the end, because I thought civil defense would, first of all, it wouldn't get very far with that background. It'd all be ex captains and majors getting their jobs, the good jobs, quite naturally. It's my job to use my wits to brains to qualify in something, and I thought medicine would suit my temperament and my. Having done some, you know, a lot of hospital work, I saw what it involved, so I wasn't green to it, I knew what it involved. I thought I could do it as well as anybody else, so I had a go at it. And luckily I got a grant in the end. Started off without a grant. In faith, as it were, and it worked out.
Do you think your experience, you know, in the hospitals in the war, and particularly in Europe, Do you think it helped make you a better doctor? Did it? Was it valuable experience for being a doctor?
Oh, well, undoubtedly, yes. I think so. I mean, I think any job, certainly doctors go into medicine, the school, university, medicine, they haven't a clue about what life's like, really. You know, I was a trainer for years in general practice, and there are very good quality people coming through, but you do need to have some sort of knowledge how the other half live. If you're going to be in the front line, okay, if you're a specialist, you don't need that, but if you're in the general practice, you do need to know a lot about people and how various people live and what their expectations are and their skills and abilities and to some extent their, I suppose, their ethos, as it were, whether they're religious sort or not, or whether they're worldly go-getters or what they are. It affects how you handle them and what they're likely to need as regards direction in their management of their complaints. So I think that background can do nobody any harm. I think it's marvellous. I'm very glad of it.
Well, Dr. Tildesley, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your World War II experiences. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's jogged a few neurones, I think, after all these years.